I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Ted Merwin, author of the new book, Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I remember the opening of the classic 1970s comedy film National Lampoon's Animal House, in which the camera pans over a statue of the university's founder showing the motto, "Knowledge is good." It's meant to be funny. You see, university mottos are always pretentious, usually in Latin, lots of lux and veritas. And they mostly mean light or truth or the light of truth, although the older ones, like Oxford's and Cambridge's, include references to God as the source of that light. But that silly Animal House, "knowledge is good" line, while funny, also encapsulates a truly meaningful Jewish point. Knowledge and learning are the path to doing good. Learning's at the heart of the Jewish experience of the world. And that's been true from the very beginning of our religion so many centuries ago up until now. The classic Jewish texts are named for various versions of the words learn, teach, or study. Torah means instruction. Mishnah means repetitive learning. Gemara means study. Talmud means educate. Midrash means probing study, and so on. Even our great mystical text, the Zohar, means illumination. Just like the concept of the light of learning that's ubiquitous in educational mottos. The Haskalah, the important Jewish Enlightenment movement of the 19th century, was focused on learning too. If Eskimos have a nearly infinite number of words that mean snow, well, we Jews have a nearly infinite number of words that mean learn. For Jews, learning begins as soon as possible. That old line in Fiddler on the Roof, "At three I started Hebrew school," was correct in that we are never too young to learn. But there's also an old joke about Jews and Catholics that highlights a problem we contemporary Jews have had with Jewish learning. It goes like this. Catholics believe in sex for children and religious instruction for everyone. Jews believe in religious instruction for children and sex for everyone. That is, we believe that our children should learn Torah, but that mature adults like us, everybody over the robust age of 13, well, we don't really need to continue our Jewish learning. While in my own congregation, Temple Emmanuel, we have had a great deal of success with our own teenagers continuing their Jewish education, in most of this country there's a significant exodus of students immediately after Bar or Bat Mitzvah. And the majority of adult Jews figure that they know plenty about the world and don't have to add to their knowledge of their own tradition. After all, they were Bar or Bat Mitzvah at 13. Everything they need to know they learned in Hebrew school. But that's simply wrong. There is virtually no area of your knowledge of life that stays at a 13-year-old level, thank God. And that should be even more true of the greatest and most ancient learning tradition in all of human history. Jewish adult education has taken a revolutionary leap forward in recent years, both in quantity, quality, and variety. And there are so many wonderful classes and courses available today. You can enroll in them at your local synagogue. My own Temple Emmanuel's Adult Education Academy in Tucson for this spring alone offers 20 different courses, many that I personally teach. One will be the second part of my course on my trip last year to the holiest places on earth, including Israel, India, and Japan's most sacred spots. And there are a plethora of other classes you can find online, teaching every aspect of the incredible storehouse of Jewish learning and wisdom, from Torah itself to Musar, the Jewish ethical tradition that last week's guest, Alan Marinas, will be teaching next weekend here at Temple Emmanuel in southern Arizona, to mysticism, to prayer, to Hebrew, Jewish history, poetry, music, literature, film, and so on. Jewish learning is definitely not just for children. And when you engage in adult Jewish study, you will learn again and again that Jewish knowledge is good indeed. To play us in on this subject of Jewish learning, here's a great cantor, Yaakov Lemmer, singing a text from Deuteronomy. The Torah is not too far from you or impossible to understand. It's right here in your hands and heart to learn and do. Sung with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, Ki HaMitzvah. That was cantor Yaakov Lemmer singing Ki HaMitzvah about Torah. When we return in a few moments on To Jewish, Ted Merwin, author of the delightful new book Pastrami on Rye, an overstuffed history of the deli, will explain what's happening to delis in America, why they've been such staples of Jewish cultural life, and his favorite deli sandwich of all when we come back on To Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish this morning, our guest, Ted Merwin. He has a doctorate, associate professor of religion and Judaic studies at Dickinson College. But most importantly for our purposes this morning, he's the author of a delightful and very interesting new book called Pastrami on Rye. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So is the study of the deli now an academic pursuit?
Well, I guess you could say that it is, I mean, in some ways. I mean, one of the things I was really trying to do with this book was to situate it very much on the line between the kind of the scholarly world and the world of all the rest of us, you know. So I don't think that the deli is necessarily any more or less appropriate as an object for for historians to look at, as really any other aspect of American and Jewish history or culture.
Is the deli disappearing?
I think in some ways it is, and in some ways it isn't. There are different ways of looking at it. There are certainly a lot fewer delis than there were when the deli was in its heyday in the earlier part of the 20th century. But there are new delis that are opening up all the time, and many of them are trying to sort of meld the best of the past with the values and the taste of the present. So I think there's a kind of glass half full or glass half empty way of looking at it.
I had the privilege of eating at Wise and Sons in San Francisco last summer with my kids. That's kind of I don't know if you know that particular one, but
I've never been there. I've certainly heard about it, and I would definitely put it in that category of new places that are really trying to reach out to a new generation.
It's kind of a boutique approach. By the way, great pastrami. What is it that
keep
makes
that in mind? I keep kosher, so...
Yeah, so it won't work, but...
It's a bit of a problem, but... although I have to say I made an exception when I was writing the book, and I ate in a number of non-kosher delis, including Katz's in New York and Langer's in L.A., and places that I had just heard you just absolutely couldn't pass up if you were going to understand anything about what the deli, you know, means in America.
It seems to me there's not necessarily a qualitative difference between a kosher deli and a non-kosher deli when it comes to the classic sandwich. Why is pastrami the classic Jewish sandwich?
You know, I think it's definitely the classic Jewish sandwich in New York, but I found that in other parts of the country it's actually not. That, for example, in Chicago, which is a very big deli town as well, the corned beef sandwich is even more iconic than the pastrami. So I think there are definitely regional differences here. But the pastrami sandwich, I think, was definably Jewish in a way that corned beef and other kinds of meat weren't necessarily. I mean, the pastrami really comes from Turkey and Romania originally, but becomes very much associated with Jews. And certainly when Jews come to America, becomes something that people really look at as a Jewish thing. So I think that's a big part of it. I think also the fact that pastrami is actually not just brined, but actually taken a step further and smoked is something that makes it in some ways even more special or even more exciting, that it's had so many steps it's had to go through in order to get to the point that it's actually finally sliced and put on the bread or put on the plate.
We will talk much more on this delectable subject with Ted Merwin, the author of Pastrami on Rye, when we come back in a few moments here on Two Jewish.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio 18, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We've got 9 months until we elect a new president of these United States. We continue our election year feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. It's hard to believe, but if the polls mean anything, the lone Jewish candidate in this presidential election, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, is in a neck-and-neck race with Hillary Clinton for the first two states sending delegates, Iowa and New Hampshire. Since no actual voting has occurred yet, but will soon, this may all be a tempest in a teapot dome. But Sanders continues his quixotic climbing campaign against the very heavily favored Hillary. Although outspent by an enormous margin, he seems to be gaining ground. Can a Jewish socialist from Brooklyn really outperform the anointed nominee of the Democratic establishment? Still seems like a very, very long shot, but we Jews are used to long shots coming in sometimes. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, there is now a Rabbi for Trump group. It was supposed to be Rabbis for Trump, but so far only one, retired Rabbi Bernard Rosenberg of Edison, New Jersey, has actually joined. On the plus side for Trump, comedian Jerry Lewis, now in his 80s, endorsed Trump, saying it's time we had a showman in the White House. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, a little while ago we were talking about the French Jewish community, anti-Semitism in Europe, and French Jews who were leaving and going other places, or at least having separate homes. We tend to think about them coming to Israel. Netanya has a big concentration, several other places right along the coast there.
A lot also.
A lot. And they may have a place in New York or even Montreal, someplace else. These obviously are fairly affluent people. But you encountered a very unusual Jewish setting in the Caribbean.
Right. I think French Jews, like American Jews, like warm and sunny places. So they tend to flock to the Côte d'Azur in France or the French parts of the Caribbean, which are numerous. Or Morocco, where a lot of French Jews have secondary residences in places like Agadir or Marrakech, whatever. But I was on Guadeloupe recently for vacation, purely. And one of the people I was with is the son of Israelis, although he was born and raised in California. He speaks fluent Hebrew and identifies, has both passports, travels on both passports, whatever. So we went the first night to a pizzeria. This is a normal Italian pizzeria in a place that doesn't have any significant permanent Jewish community, but there must be some Jews who own secondary residences or who vacation there regularly, because three of the pizza choices were called Chanukah, Bar Mitzvah, and Mazel Tov. And, you know, they weren't particularly, I mean, none of them had anything clearly non-kosher, like shrimp or bacon on them, but one had tuna, one had smoked salmon, one had smoked swordfish, which for some Jews is not kosher.
But for conservative and reform Jews, they're okay.
Right.
So, all right.
Right. And otherwise, they just had vegetables and cheese, and they were delicious. We actually went there twice, but the Israeli guy, Neil, said, like, this has got to be an elaborate practical joke. You must have done this yourself. I want to see the other menus that aren't on our table. So he checked other menus, and all the menus were the same. And then he made the servers pronounce the names of the pizzas that we got when they delivered them. He said, what's this called again? Chanukah, Bar Mitzvah. And, you know, they said it with a French accent. It was very cute and clearly evidence that there was some, at least, passing influence of Jewish tourists or Jewish families or Jewish friends, at least on the owners of this pizzeria, if not further.
You know, it's funny. I mean, the truth is you find concentrations of Jews and Jewish elements strange places. When I was in Cuzco, Peru last year at Pesach, I think I mentioned there were 1,000 people that split into two seders at the Chabad there. There were lots of kosher restaurants, or at least Israeli restaurants with signs on them, on not a very large tourist town in and very high in the Andes. So
right.
Lots of Israeli
backpackers. But there's a logical explanation, which is that a lot of Israelis, when they finish their military service, do a whole South American trail of hiking Absolutely. And backpacking. And they leave notes for each other. And there are guides in Ecuador and Peru and several other countries who are fluent in Hebrew because so many of their clients are Israelis. And so it's not surprising that there are restaurants that have menus in Hebrew or signs in Hebrew because they all are competing for this huge chunk of business.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Very interesting experience. I was one of the oldest people at this Seder, I can promise you.
Right. Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinan Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Last week, we celebrated Tu B'Shvat, and we talked about the environmental consciousness that's at the heart of this Jewish New Year for trees. Israel has really changed in this area. There were always, or for a long time, there's been these organizations, the Chevre Haganat HaTeva, which is kind of like, I don't know, youth national scouts or something. I'm not sure that there's any exact American analogy.
Something rangers?
Yeah, they're kind of park rangers, but they tend to be people, you know, it's a small country. So these areas in which there's park rangers and there's national park centers are very close to where people live. It's not like in America where you drive off to the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone or something. So there's always been some of that. But there's been a real change in the way Israelis think about recycling, caring for the environment, and that's motivated by a unique Israeli phenomenon. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so first, as we talked last week, is through the schools, of course, and when the school system in Israel, you know, it's actually controlled the majority of the school. There's no so many private schools. So when the Department of Education decided to, absorb, you would say, one of the trend, which is the recycling or preserving the earth, or you will call it however you want. So it will be all over the country, and it will start from kindergarten.
In every school?
Every school and in Israel, periphery, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, all over. So it's really like in few years, and it's and it was called, as I told you before, the revolution of the kids, because the kids were able to educate us. Probably someone was smart enough to think what will be easier to really work bottom up with the parents or.
Get their parents to change or start with the kids.
Yeah, right. So you can't say no to your kids, right? If your kid will say...
Very hard.
Abba, you need to separate this and this. You won't say, no, not today. You say, of course, let's
do it. Don't
throw
that bottle away, recycle it.
But maybe if it was vice versa and you will say to your kid, let's do this or this. So the ownership that the kid has on this trend of recycling... was the key for success, and in addition to the schools, the youth movement, which is very very strong in Israel, you know, all over Israel. If it's the scouts, if it's Bnei Moshavim, Shomer Tzair, there are many, and they also, it's, you know, it's very cool. Even they made it like cool to recycle, and, you know, not to waste food, not to waste water, not to waste, you know. And it's also important to mention that because Israel suffers for lack of water, so it's also connected not to waste water because we are suffering of lack of water. So it's
right, and you know,
all relates.
As we've covered many times on to Jewish Israel, utilizes a higher percentage of its water supply than virtually any country in the world. They do an incredible job of recycling and desalination, everything else. But it's interesting that it's come to the consciousness of the average teenager, and they're educating their parents.
Yes.
Toda rabba. Thanks so much, Ashraf.
Toda rabba.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, the head man at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Shalom, Boker Tov.
Shalom, Boker Tov. There's a news story out that the National Jewish Day School organizations have now unified Reform or Community, Solomon Schechter,
right.
Conservative, Modern Orthodox. Is this a great sign of Jewish unity, or is there something else going on?
Well, I think it's probably a mixed indicator. It's always great to see an association evolve to a place of strength. And the reality is that with the enrollment levels in Jewish day schools and the resources available to Jewish day schools, it was apparently time for these organizations to look towards a different model. So we see these national level groups consolidating, groups like RavSak and PEJ. And I'm very encouraged because they've provided a lot of support to THA over the years. And to me, as a new head of school, learning the trade and the job, I've been hooked up with a mentor, for example, and attended a national conference. And I think that they can only be stronger as they come together as a group.
So there's a secondary factor, which is, if they were all super strong and robust on their own, one suspects they wouldn't unify.
Sure.
There's kind of a larger trend, which is that day schools aren't growing across the country.
Right. We do see that communities have a mixed story to tell in terms of enrollment. In some areas, things are trending up. In other areas, things are trending down. Fortunately, at THA, we're on an upward trend.
Always like to see that.
That's right.
Some of the factors that go into the decisions that people make. For a while, day schools were going to be the future of Jewish education in America. I remember, 50 stories like that, mm-hmm. maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now people realize it's going to be a more combined picture. Day schools may be the richest way to approach getting your kids Jewish education.
Yeah.
Are there other? What are the other factors that are limiting enrollment?
Well, when it comes to an educational program, every family has to find the one that fits their needs and their interests and what their family believes in and values. So people are very busy. Life is, the weeks are limited, the days are short. And so people make decisions about what works best for their schedules, for their belief systems, for their budgets. Fortunately, at THA, for example, we're able to offer amazing scholarships. And some people feel like this is great for my schedule because I have one stop and we get a phenomenal education and a great Jewish education in one shot. Other families prefer a different model and they do after-school programming or online programming with their kids. So whatever the need is, what's exciting is that in our community, we're able to meet that with different offerings around town.
Thanks, John. We will talk next week.
All right.
When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, THAAZ.org, 529-3888.
The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you want to come on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Moshe, a medieval Jewish astrologer, prophesied that the king's favorite mistress would soon die. Sure enough, she died a short time later. The king was outraged at the astrologer, certain his prophecy had brought about the woman's death. He summoned Moshe and commanded him, "Prophet, prophesy, tell me when you will die." Moshe realized the king was planning to kill him immediately, no matter what answer he gave. "I don't know when I'll die," Moshe answered finally. "I only know that whenever I die, the king will die the very next day." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Not such a funny one this time. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as any other in the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic portions featuring some of the highlights in the whole of Jewish tradition, including all religious history, really, Mishpatim comes as a letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land. And before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had a duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Mere civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle somebody else's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for someone who hurts another or destroys somebody else's property. How we should act when somebody puts his or her property in trust. The laws of manslaughter, of theft, of damages, and so on. Boring laws. Many of them tediously detailed. Nobody likes reading law books, do they? Well, if the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interactions that seems so trivial as not really to belong in the Torah at all. Why is Mishpatim here? We human beings have no love of law, or usually lawyers, but without laws and without enforcement, we fallible creatures couldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart, and where anarchy reigns, justice doesn't. That's where Mishpatim comes in. We need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one very much. Judaism understands that if we are to be truly good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Before we can make this world holy, we must treat each other civilly. It is a great fundamental lesson. We seem to need to relearn it in every generation. A final note. At the end of this week's Parsha, after all the rules and laws, the torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. Why here?
Because in this way, Mishpatim teaches that we can only experience real holiness when we begin by respecting our fellow men and women. When we come to understand that we are all in this together, and that the way to God is through the ways we learn to work together and trust one another. We must do this in simple, practical, daily ways by following these decent rules for human interaction. Poet Adrian Rich put it well, "These atoms filmed by ordinary dust, that common life, freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose bound, routine remembering, putting together inch by inch the starry worlds." Freedom and holiness are dependent on the laws established here in Mishpatim, on the civility that rules require. May we all remember that this week and every week. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Ted Merwin, will explore the ongoing meaning of the Jewish deli in 2016 and beyond. Find out just what pastrami on rye meant to our ancestors and today when we come back on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a follow-up story, a Sarasota, Florida synagogue named Kol HaNeshama has voted to leave the Reconstructionist movement over Reconstructionism's decision to allow rabbis to marry outside the Jewish faith. The members of the synagogue voted by nearly 2-1 to end the temple's Reconstructionist affiliation and become independent. Synagogue's president has sent a letter to the movement informing it of the shul's decision. That came amid a rising tide of discord within the tiny movement over its leader's decision to allow intermarried rabbis. 7 rabbis have quit the movement in protest since the policy was implemented last September. Other synagogues are debating the issue, although none are publicly considering leaving so far. David Blatt, the Jewish coach of the LeBron James-led Cleveland Cavaliers, was shockingly fired last week in the middle of a season in which his team's record was 30 wins and just 11 losses, and was the best in the Eastern Conference of the NBA. In fact, David Blatt's record over 2 years was 83-40, more than 2 wins for every loss, and in his first year he took the Cavs to the NBA Finals. They lost in 6 games in large part because 2 of their 3 stars, Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love, were out with injuries. Blatt was fired with the best winning percentage in the history of the Cavaliers franchise. He is replaced by his top assistant, Tyronn Lue. Speculation that his firing was orchestrated by LeBron James is rampant. Blatt has had tremendous success in international basketball. He was named Coach of the Year in the EuroLeague and the Russian Super League. He's a legend in Israel, where he played as a professional for 12 years and then led the national team to the EuroLeague Championship in 2014. David Blatt will undoubtedly land another NBA job soon. Still, his firing is somewhat disturbing.
Hey, Fish.
Yeah?
There's a bankruptcy sale on this afternoon. You want to buy a cemetery plot?
I got better things to do with my money.
Might not be a bad investment. Might be able to rent it out until you needed it.
Definitely not. I'm planning on donating my body to medical science. If they'll take it.
Abe Vigoda, the very Jewish actor, famous for playing Fish on the TV detective ensemble comedy Barney Miller, died last week at the age of 94. Abe Vigoda made his first big splash playing a mobster in the movie The Godfather. He often played Italian mafia heavies. But his greatest success was as the extremely dry-humored old guy detective in the best police comedy show ever made. Vigoda even had a spin-off show from Barney Miller called Fish that lasted a couple of years in the 70s. If you haven't watched old Barney Miller episodes on YouTube or Netflix, you really need to do so. You are in for a rare treat. The acting is fabulous, led by Hal Linden's noble Jewish calm as the police captain, but the writing is just brilliant, and the rest of the cast, especially Abe Vigoda as Fish, who won 3 Emmys as Best Supporting Actor for the role, is perfect. Vigoda was born in Brooklyn, son of Russian Jewish immigrants, and acted steadily in theater from his teens. He once said, "When I was a young man, I was told success had to come in my youth. I found this to be a myth. My experiences have taught me that if you deeply believe in what you're doing, success can come at any age." He was in his 50s when Barney Miller came along. Abe Vigoda was mistakenly reported to have died in People magazine way back in 1982. He always looked old, and he made a kind of late career, making fun of rumors of his premature death, appearing in a variety of photos, sitting up in a coffin, and then showing up on David Letterman, Conan O'Brien, and other late-night shows to prove he was still alive. He even appeared with Betty White at a favorite Super Bowl ad 6 years ago. He really died only this week at the age of 94 in his sleep. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Ted Merwin is the author of the new book, Pastrami on Rye, an innovative and creative approach to studying the deli. He is the Associate Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies and Director of the Milton B. Asbel Center for Jewish Life at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. So what was your favorite deli?
Wow, there's so many. There's so many places that I ate in and so many different kinds of sandwiches that I had. But I would say that for me, since one of the things that I was writing about in the book is that it's really never just about the food itself, but it's about the environment that food is eaten in. It's about the people you're with. You know, they say you are what you eat, but for me, and definitely in terms of my understanding of the deli, it's not just, you know, you are what you eat, but you are with whom you eat, and you are where you eat, and you are, in a certain sense, when you eat. You know, I mean, there are so many different factors that go into the experience of eating.
There's something about the Jewish approach to eating, besides the sanctification of a bracha before having kosher food, but there's something about the cultural experience for Jews of eating that it's true for some other cultures, but it's unique in a way that we're Jews associate with the deli, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the deli was one of the first places where Jews could really relax, you know? I mean, it was known for being a kind of let-it-all-hang-out type of atmosphere in which Jews could be themselves, and Jews could talk with their hands, and they could talk with their mouths full, and they could, you know, be loud and boisterous and really feel like they were in a comfortable, non-threatening, non-judgmental kind of atmosphere, which was not the way they felt in the rest of society, particularly at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And so I think Jews really invented the deli as a place where they could do something in public, which they were used to doing in private, which was, you know, kind of hanging out with one another in their family and their friends. In an American context, you know, eating Jewish food in an American way, because eating out really wasn't a big part of Jewish culture or immigrant culture for most immigrants in general. I mean, most of them didn't have the purchasing power, didn't have the disposable income to be able to eat out on a regular basis. And so there was something exciting about eating out, which we've lost in many ways nowadays because we eat so many of our meals away from home, or we take out so many of our meals from restaurants. And so eating out doesn't have that thrill in some ways that it used to have.
Deli meat is actually, by and large, cheap cuts cured, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, obviously the real origin of the deli comes from the fact that meat had to be salted, had to be smoked, had to be spiced, and so on in order to preserve it. And so you could do that with pretty much any kind of meat. One of the things that I found was interesting was that in some ways one can trace the introduction of cured meat into the Jewish diet by looking at a passage in the Talmud in which the rabbis are discussing what would be the most appropriate meal to have on the eve of the fast of Tisha B'Av, which, you know, commemorates the destruction of both temples in Jerusalem, the most tragic event in Jewish history, I guess, until the Holocaust. And so the debate is, what are we going to prescribe for people to eat that's not actually going to be too pleasurable, that's going to be in keeping with the spirit and with the tone, the somber mood of the approach of that holiday or that fast day.
Commemoration, right?
Yeah, and so they decide, actually, that rather than having fresh meat, which would be too delicious.
Too luxurious, if you will.
Luxurious, exactly, right? Just like, you know, you're not allowed to wear leather and things like that on Yom Kippur. You know, you have to find ways of kind of afflicting your body. So they decided that the best way to afflict themselves would be to have to eat something, because you're not supposed to be fasting yet, you know. So you have to eat something, but they would eat meat that had been pickled.
And we've been doing it ever since, but now for pleasure.
We've been doing it ever since. And not only that, but if I can just add one quick thing, which mm-hmm. is that another thing that's interesting to me is that the sacrificial meals in the temple, the meat, the leftovers from the sacrifices that the Kohanim made on the altar, were always eaten with mustard.
That's
another thing in the Talmud.
That is not something that everybody knows.
Well, if they read my book, they'll know it.
Absolutely. I want to talk about culture, about deli culture, just a little more. I remember the first time I went into a deli and somebody said, "Can I have your order, please?" As opposed to saying, "Don't get the tongue. You won't like it. It's too fatty today. You should only get the chicken soup with matzo balls." That's a very unusual way to wait on people. It's very Jewish. It's very deli. I think it's harder to find today, thank God. But I remember Cantor's in L.A. was famous not only because it had been there forever, but because the waitresses were the rudest you'd ever experienced for a long time. How did that develop?
Well, that's actually a great segue from what we were just talking about, believe it or not, because one of the claims that I make in the book, which is maybe a little far-fetched, to use a Yiddish word, is that there's actually an analog between the priests in the temple in Jerusalem and the countermen in the Jewish delis in America, in the sense that both presided over an activity that was really essential to the community's workings and self-definition. And yet, there's a kind of very forbidding, let's say, aspect to both of them in a sense. There is this tradition of the guy behind the counter in a deli or the Jewish waiter in the deli being, as you say, very sarcastic, very contemptuous, even insulting. And I think you see this in popular culture. You see this particularly in an episode of Saturday Night Live, which you might know, from 1976 from John Belushi, which was called Samurai Deli.
Yeah.
In which he played.
My only one I like better than that was Samurai Moyle, but go ahead.
Samurai, well, yeah, I don't think there was Samurai Moyle, but
that's spectacular.
But funny, yeah, it's good. But he plays this. He plays this really kind of threatening. I mean, he's got the samurai sword. So, and the whole idea is that, I mean, this is about a time when people were starting to really worry about the health consequences of eating deli food. So the idea was that the deli was really becoming a very dangerous place, in a sense, because either if the food didn't catch you, this like crazy guy behind the counter with the samurai sword would.
John Belushi is the Kohane of the deli.
That's it. See, that's right. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. And so I think there's this sense that, I mean, obviously it's not in Saturday Night Live, but on Seinfeld that you really have the kind of apex of this stereotype. And it's not a deli.
It's the soup Nazi.
Sitting, but it's a soup Nazi, right, who is like the scariest possible guy behind the counter of a restaurant or takeout place. And so, yeah, I mean, I really struggled with this question when I was writing the book because it interested me very much as well. Is how did this develop? What was it that made people want that kind of treatment when they came into a Jewish deli? They wanted to be insulted or treated in a supercilious way. And what I realized is that a lot of these waiters were actually themselves former entertainers. At least that's what I found in New York. I don't know if that was true in L.A. as well, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Wouldn't be surprising.
And so I think there was this shtick that they were continuing to kind of, you know, and they wanted the deli to be, it was supposed to be entertaining. The deli was supposed to be a fun place, and so I think that was part of it. I think even more than that, though, was this sense in Jewish culture that people almost, in a perverse way, you know, like that, because who else could treat you that way?
Your family, only
except
your family.
A close family member or friend, right? I mean,
right.
Which is something that Jews, I think, because we come out of this culture of argument and of debate and a very loud and noisy dinner table conversation and Yiddish invective and so on and so forth, I think that there was something that was paradoxically comforting about being screamed at by the waiter as if he were your uncle or your brother or something like that. But also, I tend to look for social class explanations of things, as we were just talking about a moment ago in terms of the rise of the deli in American culture. And I think there was also a kind of melancholy aspect to this, in the sense that the waiter was very much stuck in a kind of low-status occupation, serving this type of food, which, as we said, was freighted with a lot of symbolic meaning, to his social betters, his social superiors, in a way. I mean, as his customers were becoming more upwardly mobile. And so I think there was a kind of resentment that was bubbling just below the surface that got expressed in the way that the waiter treated his customers who were on their way to becoming doctors and lawyers and so on. And what really brought this home to me was there was a waitress for many years at the Second Avenue Deli in New York, and her name was Diane Kastner. And I write about her in the book. She was totally unforgettable because she was kind of a caricature. I mean, she wore really heavy makeup pancaked on her face and beehive hairdos and lots of costume jewelry. There was just something kind of bizarre about her and something kind of sad as well. And whenever you ordered soup at the Second Avenue Deli, like I love matzo ball soup, so I would always order that. And they would bring it to you in a tin cup and they would pour it into the bowl in front of you so it would stay hot until they served it to you. And whenever she poured the soup in, she would have a saying that she would say, and she would always be the same thing. She would say, "You'll be the richer, I'll be the poorer." And that really stuck with me. You know, it was funny because I was giving a talk about the deli about a week ago, and I've given maybe, I don't know, 50 or 60 talks all over the country. And this was the first time when I started talking about this waitress, Diane Kastner, and I asked the audience, does anyone remember her, and does anyone remember what she said when she brought you the soup? And somebody said, "You'll be the richer, I'll be the poorer." I was like, wow.
Incredible.
So it wasn't just me it made an impression on.
You know, I'll tell you, we rabbis would like it if people would remember our sayings. I want to thank Ted Merwin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Pastrami on Rye. It's available, of course, on Amazon. And it's a wonderful exploration of this incredible Jewish institution. Thanks so much, Ted.
Thank you, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Rabbi Harold Kushner, author of When Good Things Happen to Bad People and the new book, Nine Essential Things I've Learned About Life. He'll be speaking at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson February 13th. Call 327-4501 for tickets. And don't miss next week's show, a Rabbi Kushner himself. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from cantors Yaakov Lemmer and Chaim David Burson. Rachem Na, Have Compassion on Us, a composition by Mona Rosenblum, first made famous by cantor Dudu Fischer, a past guest of Too Jewish. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Al Israel Amecha, Rachem na 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 na, Hashem Elokeinu, Al Israel Amecha.